You are listening to WPVM LP 103.7 in Asheville, North Carolina, and globally at WPVMFM.org.
Here's your Radio Asheville weather report. Showers and possibly a thunderstorm or two today. Patchy fog, a high near 70. Showers and thunderstorms around the area tonight. Patchy fog still, a low in the upper 50s to near 60. Breezy at times. More showers and thunderstorms for Saturday. Patchy fog and a high near 71. Showers and thunderstorms Saturday night, the low around 60. I'm Johnny Cottle on Radio Asheville 103.7.
Welcome to Twice 5 Miles Radio, fertile ground for conversations worth listening to and remembering. I'm your host, James Nave. Today, my guest is Jay Hill. Jay was one of the speakers at the TEDx Asheville 2026 event in March, and Jay had a particularly interesting talk with props and a provocative idea that I had never heard before. And he was hilarious. He was, as I said, provocative. Also, his talk was full of ideas and thoughts that would never occur to me. It's about something that all of us do every single day. So he has a new take on it. I helped Jay rehearse his talk, and I was also in the audience when he delivered it. Fellow did a masterful job. So let's turn to our conversation. And I began by mentioning that I was in the audience, and we'll let Jay take it from there. So here we go. So when you developed your TEDx Asheville talk, I was there for part of it. I watched you work with it. You and I gathered at the Lake Eden Barn one afternoon, and you were, yes, were working with it. And it's a fantastic talk. I know it's up live now on Big Ted, as we call it. I don't know if Big Ted calls itself Big Ted or not, but I like to say Big Ted. Big Ted is actually the platform for those of you listening. It's the platform that invites speakers from the TEDx arena around the world to join in their dissemination process. It's a digital platform. But when I worked with you, I could see your dance between the being and the project. It was on full display, and you leaned into the project part, the step one, step two, step three, step four, step five, step six, step seven, step six, step seven, say that fast. And it worked. I attempted to just disrupt that some when we were rehearsing, because I could see this other side of you. And let's just call it the being side. And really, the being side isn't so much a complacent side as it is more of a broad vision side, where I'm going to allow my vision to expand, hopefully, into an awareness of 360. So I'm not just working on a project. I'm letting all the possibilities enter, some of which would be disruptive, perhaps, that I can't control. And yet those uncontrollable impulses that rise from you are part of what I like to call being. I'm just here. I'm receiving it in the same way that a tree in a storm practices being. The tree's not going to do anything except just accept the storm. And so I was trying to get you to accept something I saw in you, not external, but internal, some urgency to make something splash, dazzle. Now, does that sound intriguing to you? And I've never told you that, because I didn't say that at the rehearsal, but that's what I was after from you.
Yeah. Splash is an interesting word to use. What I remember from that day is that you were pushing at me to get a little bit out of my head and more into the, like, emotional why behind, like, why am I giving this talk? Why am I going to be on stage just like now? I'm not a super emotive person. I definitely appreciate that, and I understand the value of it. I could feel it as we went through the exercise, and then I started again. So you and the other people who were there in that barn respond to that shift in energy when I was not going through the motions I have rehearsed, but allowing myself to be driven was like I was being pushed rather than I was pulling.
And it was interesting for me because I quickly got it that you like to be the one in charge of the agenda in terms of how you want to present something. I've rehearsed this, I've planned this, I've laid it out. There's a precision involved in it. And I'm a fan of rehearsing, laying out, and precision. Believe me, I think it's essential. If you've ever built a house and you didn't have a plan, the thing fell over fairly soon. So I'm a big fan of that. I also was curious to see how you would, in the resistance that you had, to see how you would take those notes and incorporate them into the resistance. So I was attempting to create a dramatic tension between the resistance or the already existing agenda, which I valued because I saw that as a great string, and to add that dash of color from the other side of the fence and see what happened. And so even though you think of yourself, or at least you said, I like to stay within my head, my comfort zone, or whatever you want to call it, you actually took the note really well because you managed to retain all of your structure, but you also added that maybe you were angry, maybe you were irritated, maybe you were something, but whatever the emotional thing was that's bubbled up, it wrapped itself around the already existing structure. And it then came alive.
Yeah. Use the metaphor of the tree and the storm. If a tree could imagine a storm coming and structure itself in a way that it thinks it needs to be to withstand the storm, I think that's not going to be enough when the storm shifts directions. It needs something more. If I just have the script and I'm clinging to it as the structure I need to get through this, that's not enough. Things happen in ways beyond what we imagine. Like leading up to TEDx was very much an exercise of imagining myself on the stage, imagining myself giving the talk, imagining, oh, here's where I think people will laugh at this line. Here's where I think people will feel a deeper, more significant point hitting. And it doesn't exist. It's just my anticipation of how people will respond. So going through the exercise with you was part of building a deeper root system and a capacity to think beyond my imagining of how it would go.
Continue with the metaphor of the tree based on what you just said. The tree, when it was a sapling, it imagined the storm coming, and then it prepared itself for the storm with the root system. And by the time the storm was coming across the horizon, if the tree can think, maybe they can, the tree didn't have to worry so much about the deeper prep because it had already been thought of. And in a sense, that's what I was attempting to do with our rehearsal, build a deeper prep into the root system so that if you encountered a bit of a turbulence on the stage, the prep would be available to help support you as that turbulence happened. I don't know if it did happen for you on the stage or not at the theater the day of the TEDx talk. You came out and did a great job of improvising it. It was almost stand-up comedy, really, I thought, as much as it was anything else. And that's no shade on the content, which actually opens this door right now to invite you to tell us a bit about the content of your talk. And okay. I'd like for you to also report on how you feel now that it's up on Big Ted and how it changed you when you did the talk. Those are a lot of questions, but just freeform that a bit. Yeah. It's like, what's going on with it? How come your TEDx talk is up there? How does it feel?
Mm-hmm. First, I'll go back to the tree and the storm and the roots. You know, the roots do nothing for the tree if they're not gripping something. And I feel like that's what all the preparation was, the exercise that we did in the Parn, the work I did with other members of the cohort over the month leading up to the event, that was really sinking those roots into something that made me feel confident coming out there onto the red rug at TEDx. So the content of my talk, and I did not share this with folks in advance of the event. I talked about men sitting down to pee. And my choice to not talk about it was because when I first, I applied not thinking anything would come of it because I knew many people applied. And so when it became real that I was selected, I did tell a couple of people and immediately there were questions and thinking about the reality of the future that I would be on that stage giving that talk. And in a sense, people have used the phrase coming out as a sitter. I would start to feel sweaty and anxious about it because I hadn't put together the talk yet. I didn't have like an elevator pitch to give to people. And so I just decided telling people about it gives too much away. I want there to be kind of a reveal in the talk. And because it's not just about the mechanics, it's about the why, but more so about why is this, like, why do I feel sweaty when I think about talking about it? And why haven't I talked about it for the decades that I've been practicing it? What kind of holds us back from that? And I didn't have a way that I felt good talking about that in advance, so I just decided not to. Yeah, the talk starts with a bit of a review. I had some props, then gets into some of the physics of why standing is an absurd thing that we accept us as a society, given the mess that it leaves behind, and the question of who becomes responsible for cleaning up that mess. And if it's not the person who is making it, who is it falling to, and is that acceptable and why? And then, like I said, getting into acquires this hard to talk about and what are our hangups around this as a society. It does vary globally. There's quite a lot of variance globally about this practice.
Well, Jay, this may make you sweat a bit more, but every time I take a comfort break, I think of you. So after I saw that talk, I can't get you out of my mind up there on that TEDx Asheville stage. So
I love that for us.
I'm one of many. I'm one of many a follower. Be more specific here. Describe the day you getting ready to walk out onto that stage. It was for me a delight. You can see I'm smiling on our Zoom call here, even though people will only hear this audio on the radio. Give us a sense of it.
It was an incredible experience. It was beyond my expectations, the response of the audience. And of course, TEDx always has a super supportive audience. They're there on purpose. They're there to hear fresh ideas, perspectives. But it was beyond really my expectations. I'm not a professional public speaker and I'm not new to it, but I was pretty nervous. I don't know how the crowd size compares to other talks that I've given, but it felt more substantial. It's definitely a bigger lead up. TED brand carries such weight, really significant. And there was this revealing of myself in the topic as well. So I start with this kind of table out there that actually turns out to be a stand-in for a toilet. And there's a moment where I sit down on it and I say to the audience, my name is Jay Hill. And yeah, I sit down to pee. And the crowd erupted in applause. And I did not anticipate that. I thought it would just be kind of some awkward laughter. Throughout the talk, people were just laughing at a lot of points that I didn't even really expect them to. Like, there were some intentional jokes in there, but there were also things that people laughed at unexpectedly. Yeah, it caught me off guard a little bit. So use the word improvisation. Definitely the content, there was not a lot of improvisation in that because I had rehearsed it so much, but I did try to deliver it not as a rehearsed speech so much. There are a couple of things that I switched up in the moment just based on the audience reaction. The little extra line here or there is like, oh, they already get it. They already get the joke. I don't need to throw it head in.
Were you able to feel okay with your improvisational moments around the laughter that you weren't expecting?
You know, one thing that I've been a little bit hung up on through the process is the length of the talk.
Uh-huh.
So there was I'm involved with Projector Nights, and those talks, so I've given a number of those, and those talks are always 6 minutes and 40 seconds exactly. That's the format. You prepare 20 images and are shown for 20 seconds each. They move automatically. And so that's a format that I worked with for over a decade. And I love it for its brevity. Its structure is really accessible to people that don't have a lot of public speaking experience. And so having this more open-ended, but still limited, you can't cut up their entire for 20 minutes, was a little challenging. And so I wanted to make it short. I knew that there would be a video artifact coming out about it, a video of the talk. And I was really trying to make it between 6 and 7 minutes. And I didn't come anywhere close to that. I would rehearse it without proud laughter. And it was taking like between 8 and 9 minutes. I can't cut anything more. I spent so much time cutting. I cut so much out of the talk. And I got to the point where I was like, I think this is it. This is what I'm working with. And the video was over 13 minutes long. It's just over 13 minutes because of pauses that I had to introduce just waiting for the audience, which was super gratifying. I don't have a problem with it. You know, you mentioned earlier, you asked about how it feels having the video up. One thing that I anticipated was maybe a lot of resistance to this idea of men sitting down to pee or feel threatened by it. And that has not materialized. Messages have all been supportive. And one of the surprising things has been just how many people have said, oh, I've been doing this for a long time. This is my practice. And some people came up with it on their own, and others were asked to do it by their domestic people that they live with. And so that's been really one of the really interesting outcomes of this, because I always wanted the video artifact to be permission for people to talk about this, whether it's bringing it up with someone who is making a mess in the bathroom, or to feel more comfortable talking about it. And that has come to pass. I think the mixed part about it, you know, you talked about projects and identity, and you're giving a TED talk. This was a big effort, and like I said, the TED brand carries such weight. And so having the video out there, and you know, our something like 1,300 views on the video is respectable. The people that I know and care about have all watched it and shared very nice words, and it's not a viral sensation, and that's okay. Idea of validation through view count is hard to separate oneself from. So there was a moment where it's like, oh, I see it trailing off. My friends and acquaintances, a couple of degrees have seen it, and now it's kind of done, and that chapter is feeling more closed. And it, you know, took me a day or two to make peace with that, that it wasn't something that was going to carry on a little bit longer.
That's an interesting observation. I know that the count does matter to people. And one of the things that I have learned about those counts, they exist because most of the time the people push them to start it. So they'll put a big push behind it. And once that push happens, then they get more numbers. So I don't know how much you've pushed yours and how active you've been promoting it with on all of your platforms. If you do promote it on the platforms, people will watch it. And that's how you get those numbers. Of course, you know this. I mean, you're in the business of thinking about these things. I know you work in this arena, so you're not unfamiliar with all.
Well, I work in technology, and I don't build up a personal brand. I don't have a book. One of my favorite things about working in the aesthetics process was getting to spend time and getting to know my cohort of co-presenters. And there was a moment where I had a bit of imposter syndrome based on the fact that the talk wasn't part of a bigger story of like books that I'm promoting, or I've got a book coming up, or I have a podcast. I don't have any of that. And I'm not trying to be the sit down to pee guy that gets recognized on the street or that has a book or something. I said out loud at once, I was like, am I supposed to have a book? And realize that doesn't have to be part of a story.
Going back to the idea that this might be something that would upset people or you would get pushback, when I think about the idea that you presented, it was more for me something that I just hadn't noticed. I hadn't thought of. It wasn't some dramatic push that came out of the bushes and scared me or pushed me or did anything to me. It was like, that's a good idea. I've never thought of it before. And that may be why you're not getting a lot of pushback in a negative way, is because it's so obvious and it's been there all along. And then I've actually thought, as I've been standing or sitting, depending on how shamed I've been by your talk, I will think, now, is
or Jay, I mean, your public restrooms, all bets are off.
I've been thinking, okay, now Jay says the splatter happens in minuscule ways that you don't actually see it. I wonder if he's right, and I will observe my moment and think, well, now maybe he's not. And then I think, well, I don't know. These little droplets are invisible. Like he said, I wonder where they're going. I don't know if I should praise you or hate you, Jay, but I tend to think about it a fair amount.
Yeah.
And I say that in the best way of complimenting you, because it's very seldom in my life that somebody brings up something that's that useful that keeps me thinking about it. So I just
it's one of those things that once you hear it, you can't unhear it. And I think it is a message that maybe there are people who would be resistant to it, but it's a message for people who have ears for it, who like you said, just it hadn't occurred to me, but it makes sense.
And one of the things I think made it work so well for me and all the others laughing in the audience, good comedy does more than just make a person laugh. Good comedy,
absolutely, yeah,
drives a fairly sizable freight train through the room if it's done well. And what I loved about what you were saying, and I noticed this in the barn, and that may be one of the reasons when we were rehearsing why I got all over you a bit, pushed it a bit. I could see the the social implications and the cultural implications of those questions. Who am I to make this mess and leave it for somebody else to clean up? And that's the existential question that we are asking as humans across the board. So this business of going to the toilet and having your comfort break, everybody does it. And yet you were asking such a big question there. And I really noticed it right away. And I don't know if you saw it out of the gate or not, but I do believe you came to understand the value of what you were reaching for and indeed achieved. You reached for it and you grabbed hold of the ring.
Yeah, it did become bigger than I had initially envisioned it. There was always kind of the fairness aspect to it, and it grew to something a little bit bigger than that. I mentioned that I had spent a lot of my preparation time cutting content. And some of the stuff that I cut was more on the nose commentary about that. This idea of sitting down to pee as an issue of fairness is emblematic of bigger patterns. It's not strictly about this one act, but awareness of the work that we are creating for other people, people that we care about often, people that we should care about. And in cutting out kind of the exposition about that, I realized that it made the talk stronger because the audience is smart and the audience is going to get that message in a more powerful way if I don't spell it out. They're going to get exactly the message that is powerful to them. I've heard from people who attended the talk or watched online some of the key things that they took out of it. And I'm trying to think of a couple examples here, but that's when I noticed that having taken out that explicitness opens that up, because there were very different ideas. And if I had been explicit, then it would have closed the door to some of these takeaways that they found. Like they found, oh, this actually applies to my life in this way. Or like, I can understand my father better because you said this. Yeah. That wasn't what the talk was about, but it was for them.
Well, you bring up a fantastic point around generating content that will be useful for people. I got a lot out of the talk. I mean, obviously, you can see I did, because I'm still yakking about the thing long after. I tell people about it, so it gets spread around a bit. When we come at a talk from a writing point of view, so often people they feel like they have to editorialize. I have to explain to you these five or six or seven or eight things, and this is how you should feel, or this is how I feel. And what happens when you try to fill in all of that editorial stuff, those explanations, you disallow the listener the opportunity to fill those blanks in for themselves. Like if you put too many examples of your father in there, I will not put my brother in there, because you've already crowded my imagination with something about you. And most people don't, who start out doing this or try to do this, they tend to editorialize a great deal. I really must explain, but maybe, and I'll ask this, this is a question that just popped up. You obviously think a great deal. You're in a business that requires a fair amount of smarts, maybe a bit of genius along the way. I don't know where you put yourself on that spectrum. But maybe because you do have such a keen mind, maybe you intuitively understood how essential it was to leave that out, to give other keen minds the opportunity to fill it in. Do you think that was the case? Or was this some sort of instinct that happened?
I would like to claim more credit for it than I think I'm due. I really think that because I wrote a lot of it out, I did connect a lot of the dots and give examples. But there's drive to shorten it, led me to cut those things out. And this quality was more emergent from that process, getting things to their essential point. And even some of the like textual stuff. At one point I had a whole section of the talk, not long, but about what this looks like in other countries, and Germany in particular, where there's a pretty strong sitting culture, but they're not above still making fun of you if you sit. The word is Sitzpinkler, for one who sits to pee. And that would have been a great laugh if I had included that in the talk. The day after the talk, someone who had attended it, who I'm friends with, texted me and said, I really enjoyed it. And did you know in Germany, men sit and they have a word for it, and it's Sitzpinkler. And my initial reaction was, I should have left it in. After a moment, I realized, no, like I don't need to tell people things that they already know. Like she would have maybe loved to hear it because she already knows it, but maybe she actually prefers to tell me about it outside of it. And it's, I don't think anyone's experience was diminished by the fact that I had cut that content out.
Well, Jay, if you'd left all the jokes in, you wouldn't have had a 12-minute talk. You would have had a 30-minute talk. You wouldn't have had room for the people to laugh at the other jokes. It was really loaded. But I want to go back to when you entered the stage, because I think people, I love this visual. You walked out and you were well-dressed, sharp fellow, beard, nicely put together. So clearly you have control. And that's exactly what you want on stage. I think Frank Sinatra did a great job of control. If you've ever watched a Frank Sinatra concert, he walks out in a tuxedo. There's a reason why Frank has a tuxedo on. Come on. And when you see Frank in those concerts walking out with that tuxedo, you know things are going to be all right. A little bit of upgrade's going to happen because he's wearing his tuxedo. And he opens sometimes with, I've got you under my skin. You know, he really pulls people in. But you walked out all sharp and ready to go. And everything was clean. And you opened the talk by doing something dramatically unexpected. So I'd like for you to tell us what that was that you did that was so unexpected, so really out of character for you.
Yeah. Well, I will say that I did kind of, you know, I was trying to look sharp, but not dress up too much. There was some debate even the day before. Do I wear this nicer sport coat or actor not to do that? Yeah, I walked out on stage where there was this real stool with a parable on it and a glass. And I stood there on the rug and I said, I have a confession. I used to do this. I set the glass on the floor of the stage. And from waist high, I just dumped out the bottle, entered glass, and it splashed all over the stage. People had no idea what was going on. I laughed awkwardly about it, anticipating, like, what is coming next? What is this about? And I proceeded to decide that it's not just me, that billions of people do this every day. And then I revealed that I'm not talking about splashing apple juice on the kitchen floor, I'm talking about the batter.
It really worked visually, I have to say. And that contrast between you being snappy on the stage, and you didn't overdo it. You could have pulled the elitist card had you played the clothes a little bit differently. You didn't. You dressed exactly the way you needed to. And the contrast between the snappy dressing, which was somewhat casual and easygoing, and all that splashing really set the tone for the rest of it. I mean, it was funny from the gate. And once you get somebody to laughing, it feels so good to laugh that I want to do more of it. So you really set the stage for the laughter to come. And also I'm thinking now when I laugh in an audience. You know, I'm laughing as an audience member. I set myself up to hear humor and levity in the subtext of something, of what people are saying. So my ears are ready for it because it feels good. I don't know if that was the case necessarily with everybody, but you said some of the places people laughed, you didn't expect it. Can you remember one of those places that got a laugh, that caught you off guard, that you didn't expect?
Yeah. So second quarter of the talk, I go into some of the physics of standing versus sitting. And you, the beginning of that section, I talk about the work of the Splash Lab at Brigham Young University. And
it's funny now, Jay. Come on.
It's funny now. So I launch into it by saying students of fluid dynamics. And people just laughed and laughed at that phrase, students of fluid dynamics. I did not anticipate that that was funny. Any more than saying students of linear algebra. But I guess in this context, getting into the more, even thinking that there's an academic side to peeing into a toilet was humorous. And then I, you know, I waited for the applause to die down and I said, at Brigham Young University, and people lasted again.
Well, it's such a contrast. Brigham Young University is a Mormon university in a very conservative area. I mean, if anybody's ever seen the two Mormon missionaries walking around with their ties and their shirts, and, you know, if there's a picture of conservatism, those two missionaries, wherever they are in the world, they're conservatives. So the idea of what was it again? The splash fluidity. What was
Splash Lab?
Splash Lab. But what were the students doing? The studying fluidity. What did you call
students
it?
Students of fluid dynamics.
Yeah, students of fluid dynamics. Well, the minute you said that, I had this vision of these young students in some lab somewhere running around in raincoats, studying the fluid dynamics as the sprinklers were all spinning above their heads, almost like wet wizards or something. And then when you said at Brigham Young University, I would never, ever picture these students doing that. Now, admittedly, the conservative students at Brigham Young probably weren't wearing raincoats running around in the as sprinklers, but you offered me an opportunity to visualize quite imaginatively this big scene. Whereas students of algebra, all I think of is a bunch of, you know, myself in the 10th grade trying to do my algebra and not really understanding. So you put you made it wet.
Yeah. There was a funny part in there and I hadn't gotten to it yet because these students, you know, they do study. They have in your lab urinals and toilets, and they use high-speed cameras and black lights to study what happens when you use these devices in different ways. And they refer to themselves as the whiz kids, as like, that's the funny part, and I wasn't even there yet.
Yeah, and the thing about the whiz kids, all due respect to the joke, it's slightly expected.
Yeah.
Now, I will say you handled that well. And there was an improvisational intuition going on, because after you had hit those joke marks that you weren't expecting, I did watch you adjust your punchline, and you pull back on it a little bit. So you reevaluated and then recalibrated your expectations so that you actually then understated the whiz kids. I was watching you do this from the stage. You might have been thinking about that, or you might have just been doing it intuitively, but you certainly could, if you wanted to write a mathematical formula of how that worked, you could. And you landed it at the whiz kids. You landed it softly rather than loud.
Yeah, we weren't at a point that was going to land as a big laugh, and I can sense the way that floor was going. And so that was people were enjoying themselves. And that's that's what I was hoping for. So I don't have a stake in which hurt people find funniest.
Oh, well, you succeeded at it. That is for sure. It was just absolutely a terrific talk. And you know, Jay, I just looked down at my timer, and I don't know how much of a sense of time you have, but we've been talking solid for 50 minutes. I never did start the interview by saying you're on the radio. We just started talking. I hope that's okay with you.
Yeah, I didn't even realize we had started for a while.
I didn't either, but then I thought this is too good to leave behind. I'll just have to keep Jay in this place. So as we finish our time together, would you tell folks how they can find your TEDx Asheville talk and give them some direction on what to do and where to stand or sit when the need arises?
Yes, absolutely. So the talk is on the TEDx Talks YouTube channel called TEDx Talks. And if you search for the title of the talk is Take a Stand by Sitting Down to Pee. So if you search for some portion of that, you should find it on the TEDx Talks YouTube page.
Well, Jay, I do appreciate you entertaining me. It's been a delight to relive that moment. And I, for those of you out there listening, I hope you are able to go take a look at this talk. And now that we've deconstructed it a bit, you might be able to see some of those moments that Jay mentioned. So, Jay, thank you so much for being with us. I really do appreciate it.
Yes, thank you so much. And there's a surprise at the end of the talk that nobody, even my fellow speakers, knew was coming. So one last gag, but I...
Yeah, I did. Okay, folks.
Okay.
There you go. I hope you are able to look at it, and I promise you when you do, you will be smiling just like Jay and I are smiling right now. Again, thank you, Jay.
Thank you so much.
And there you go, my friends. You now have a much better idea of what Jay's subject was. Sit down to pee. So we have a bit of time before the top of the hour, and in this time, I'd like to reflect a bit on the ideas that Jay and I talked about regarding his rehearsal process. We mentioned the barn. The barn is located on the Lake Eden property in Swannanoa, North Carolina. The Lake Eden property is adjacent to Camp Rockmont, and the Lake Eden property and Camp Rockmont have shared the location for the Leaf Festival since 1995. And now the Leaf Festival has moved to a new location, and Lake Eden property and Camp Rockmont are both looking forward to hosting other events, festivals, gatherings, workshops in the spirit of Black Mountain College, which was located on the property between 1937 and 1956. Black Mountain College was an inspiration for the arts back then and still is today. And one of the reasons I bring it up is because the barn, which Jay and I talked about in our conversation, was built by Black Mountain College students and is now used at the Lake Eden property for weddings, events, small concerts, workshops, all kinds of gatherings. It's a terrific place, and it has a stage, and it was really quite suitable for our rehearsal for the TEDx Asheville event. So the afternoon Jay and I talked about, one of the best things about these rehearsals, many of the people who were giving their talks gathered to help each other out. So the day that Jay and I were working in the barn, Megan O'Malley was there, Allegra Houston also, David Huff, George Hope Johnson. Jay, of course, was there. So was Jennifer Pickering and Dr. Lisa Raleigh. So the rehearsals always went very smooth because people were there to experiment, to play around, to shake things up a bit, to disturb the dust, if you will, the dust that might still be on the material they're trying to present. So my job was to help them find their way into the storytelling part of their talk, help them to feel comfortable with the idea of just talking it rather than giving a speech or speechifying it, as some people call it. So you might be interested to know, I learned much of what I know about helping people present their work on stage. Years ago, when I was working with middle school students and high school students, teaching them how to perform poetry as a way of studying poetry. And one of the things I noticed when I was working with these students all the years ago, and also I've noticed this when I've worked with adults over the years as well, people generally will give you the information they want you to have about the things they're uncertain about when they give their talks. You can maybe hear the way the voice sits in the throat, or the hesitation in the way they move, or somebody might be stiff on stage. Little cues like that collect over the rehearsal period. And when I'm watching, I can see these, and it's fairly easy to spot. And when I see them, I worked with the students long enough, and I've worked with adults long enough to know how to dig a little deeper into those moments. Like with Jay, for instance, I could tell Jay was quite attached to the script. He wanted to get it right. So Jay was working with this idea of, I've got to get this perfect. I've got to get this right. While I'm a big believer in excellence, I'm less impressed with the idea of trying to get perfection to happen, because I think perfection has already happened. We don't need to strive for that, but we can strive for excellence. And one of the best ways to achieve excellence is disruption. And what I mean by that, Jay was trying too hard to get it right. So when I was rehearsing with Jay, working as a director on stage with him, I pushed him a bit. I said, Jay, you know, why are you so stiff? Jay, can you loosen up a little bit? Oh, you're still a little too stiff. The idea was to shake him up just a little bit, to get him a bit out of his comfort zone, maybe irritate him slightly so that he would bring some emotional work to the piece. And that was what was missing with Jay. He didn't quite understand how to bring the emotionalism into what he was saying. But after I wiggled around a bit and poked at it a little bit, he began to become more and more emotional, more committed to what he was trying to say. And the more committed he became, the more insight he gained around what he actually wanted to accomplish on the stage. And I told him that his bigger objective, because he was saying sit to pee, funny, it was really quite humorous. I pointed out to him also that there was more to it than that. Even though he was coming close to stand-up comedy, and I was confident that it would work, I also told him that he was speaking from a greater social point of view. The billions of people out there in the world who can't really sit to pee because they don't have toilets. There are billions of people out there in the world who are struggling with messes that need to be cleaned up. Somebody made those messes. Who made those messes? Where did those messes come from? Who will clean them up? So I pointed out to Jay that even though his talk was funny, humorous, and I knew it would work, he was also speaking to a much greater existential dilemma that the human condition has and maybe always has had. And so where does the responsibility lie? And as we talked about that, Jay started to realize this talk is much more than a talk about a man in a bathroom or men in bathrooms sitting down or how everybody has to sit down to do something when they go on a comfort break, just depending on what it is. So Jay was quite on point with that. And once he realized that he was speaking to this greater notion of human responsibility, the responsibility we have for each other, then he had more power in what he wanted to say. There was more emotion in what he wanted to say. And I was really pleased with how he took that note and moved through it. Now, the other people that day also had different things they needed to work with. Allegra Houston moved her arms too much. That told me that she had a lot of excitement. That also told me that if she contained her movements, the excitement would come out in different ways. More containment, more emotional movement with the voice, for example. Megan O'Malley was concerned because her talk was too long, and she knew it. So I helped her find ways to shorten her talk. And I also created a dialogue between what she was saying and my responses. So when she would make a comment, I would go, wait, tell me, say that again, please. I'm not quite sure if I understood it or not. And when I asked those questions, she shifted from just delivering the talk or delivering the line to actually speaking the line as if she were talking in a cafe. And that was her goal for her talk. David Huff, David had his talk down. He was very smooth. I pointed out that he might be too smooth. Maybe he wanted to fool around a little bit more on stage so that he wouldn't relax into the smoothness. He was an experienced speaker, so sometimes the experience will create the problem for you because you think you've got it and you don't bring a freshness to it. George Hope Johnson, who was the youngest member of the troupe, and his talk was about the community that he's in, the transgender community. George was confident, quick, very seasoned with his work, even though he was young. He was a little concerned about the topic. So what I did with George, we had a conversation around the courage he must muster in order to give the talk and how it was okay to have that courage. And when he was giving his talk, when I could see him holding back a little bit, I would stop him and say, okay, George, now's the time to just dial it up, dial it up. You don't have to keep it dialed up on the stage, but dial it up right now, George, and see what happens. And George, having as much experience as he had had over the years, even though he was young, about 20, I think, but he had been in high school speech competition. So he had some chops. So George could, he took those notes from me. And then Jennifer Pickering, her quest was to tell a story about coming home. Jennifer's home is the Lake Eden property. Her family has owned that property since the 40s, and she's been there all her life. My note to Jennifer was, soften it a little bit. Really drop into the images. Don't just tell it like you've told it before. This is a very new approach to an old story. So take it easy. Don't try to push it. Just tell it and keep smiling. Dr. Lisa Raleigh's talk was about the French Broad River and the other rivers in Western North Carolina. And she was referencing her talk around Hurricane Helene, which devastated the Western North Carolina area. And she mostly was focusing on the riparian zones, those rich banks that grow around the river to hold the river in when everything is healthy. So my note to Lisa was, Lisa, you are the river. You are speaking for the river. Let the river flood through you. And when I gave her that note, she eased down a bit. And indeed, I do believe I saw the river flowing through her. So those are some of the simple little rehearsal techniques that I used with folks that afternoon. We rehearsed quite a bit. I did a lot of individual rehearsing with many of the folks. And in the individual rehearsals, we would work for an hour with this kind of approach. And by the time the show started, everybody walked on the stage and they were prepared for what they wanted to say. They were also prepared to deal with whatever happened during the show. There were 500 people in the audience. So if you're developing your TED talk or any other talk, the reason why it's important to disrupt yourself, to rehearse quite a bit, get everything as comfortable as possible, because when you do walk out on a stage, no matter how small or large the audience, things happen on the stage. And one of the main things that often happens on the stage that you can never prepare for, audience response. People laugh when you don't think they'll laugh. They cheer when you don't think they'll cheer. They clap when you don't think they'll clap. You expect one thing, they give you another. And if you are prepared with deep rehearsal and these little things happen, it's easy to deal with. If you haven't prepared, they might throw you. If you're in a smaller venue, like a cafe, some kind of the student center, any smaller venue, all kinds of weird little things can happen. People drop glasses, motorcycles rev up outside, cars go by. So when you're in those smaller venues, the best thing to do is to use whatever happens to your advantage. So if a motorcycle starts up outside, just stop and say, I paid that guy to start that motorcycle. I hope you enjoyed it, and then move on. So there are a lot of ways to go about it. Everybody on the stage at TEDx Asheville did a terrific job. I was really, really pleased to see how they rose to the occasion. If you'd like to see all of it, you can easily search TEDx Asheville 2026 Talks. You'll see it pop up on YouTube, and you can watch all these folks in action. So speaking of action, this is pretty much the end of our time together, a little action concluding. And on that note, I would like to say thank you ever so much for tuning into Twice 5 Miles Radio, fertile ground for conversations worth listening to and remembering. I'm your host, James Nave. Walter Parks, thank you for the theme song, walterparks.com. For more on Walter's music, Devine Dial, thank you for managing WPVM-FM in Asheville. Robin Collier and Mike Tilley, thank you for doing the same, managing KCEI-FM, Cultural Energy Radio in Taos, New Mexico, broadcasting all the way up into Alamosa, Colorado. If you'd like to reach me, Nave at jamesnave.com. Nave is spelled N-A-V-E. I would love to hear from you. And if you like to write, you can always join me and my creative collaborator, Allegra Houston, who gave one of the TEDx Asheville speeches. We host a writing circle, a gathering every Saturday between 12 and 1 p.m. Eastern Time. It's on Zoom. It's open. It's free. It's a good community. People call in from, they call in from lots of places around the world. We haven't had anybody call in from Antarctica yet, but we have had plenty of folks call in from other locations. So we'd love to have you be part of that if you are so moved. And you can find that information at jamesnave.com and also at imaginativestorm.com. imaginativestorm.com. So there you go, my friends. Thank you ever so much for spending this time with me. I really do appreciate it, and I hope you come back sometime soon. And until then, I'll catch you on that turnaround somewhere down the line.
This is Gabe.
This is Hayden.
This is Ollie.
And this is Matty from Quick Romance, and you're listening to Radio Asheville WPVMLP 103.7 on the dial and streaming at radioasheville.org.
Just a foolish dreamer, but I don't care. 'Cause I know my happiness is waiting out there somewhere. I'm searching for that silver lining, horizons that I've never seen. Oh, I'd like to take just a moment and dream my dream. Oh, dream my dream. Oh, stars at night. I'd like to know the taste of honey in my life, in my life. Well, I've shed so many pains, and I've played so many games. Somehow, somewhere, someday.